So the big question is this: how do investors like us get access to the ideas, information, and most importantly, the right people that give us the tools and information we need to make informed and educated decisions to have success? That is the question, and this podcast will give us the answers. This is Mark Moss, your host. Let's get this started. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Market Disruptors Podcast. Today, I am sitting down with Mark Yusko from Morgan Creek, and his experience working with institutions and endowments through what he calls alternative investments, as well as his amazing view of the macro, the global economic view, led to some very interesting conversations. We talked about the evolution of Bitcoin growing to mass scale adoption. We talked about the current state of the global economy, what's going on with that. We talked about what he calls China playing Go. And then we talk about Bitcoin. Where does it fit into all of this? How people should be approaching it, risk levels, et cetera. Some really good conversations I really enjoyed. Let's go ahead and just jump right into it.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Market Disruptors Podcast. Today, I am sitting down with Mark Yusko from Morgan Creek Capital, and I am super honored to be with him. He's one of the hardest working guys in the space. And so welcome, Mark.
Well, thanks for having me, and great to be with you. And I'll try to live up to the hardest working title. It's a big shoes to fill, but I appreciate that.
Well, you're definitely doing your part. So, Mark, for those that aren't aware, why don't you just tell us a little bit about like what you've been doing and how you got here and what you're doing right now?
Yeah. So the short version, I always say I don't do short well, but the short version is, I came out of the investment world. I worked for an insurance company and an asset management firm. Got into endowment management back at my alma mater at Notre Dame, spent 5 years there as a number two. Then I took over as the head of University of North Carolina. This is a long time ago, back 21 years ago, but 15 years ago, spun out on my own and formed Morgan Creek. And the whole idea about Morgan Creek was to bring alternative investments to lots of investors. So, build products and services that would allow people to integrate this idea of alternative investments into their portfolios. Now, little did I know that it would come full circle here today, back from hedge funds 20 years ago and private equity and venture capital. And now we're talking about crypto assets and cryptocurrencies. So pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Really alternative now.
Yeah. And Morgan Creek today is a registered investment advisor. We've got just under a couple $1 billion of assets, a lot of that in private investments. And then a year ago, we launched a new subsidiary called Morgan Creek Digital, and we've raised a venture fund around that to invest in infrastructure and crypto itself. And just excited about this new set of opportunities and how it all fits together in the big world in which we all have to deploy capital into today.
Yeah. So I'm super interested to hear your viewpoint on this because of where you sit, having previously worked with endowments and now today kind of with Morgan Creek Digital working with institutions and whatnot. So I think Bitcoin's emergence has been a little bit different in a sense where it started retail. But really to kind of get to mainstream at some point, if we believe it's going to be this store of value, there's probably going to be this evolution that it has to go from maybe a collectible where it's at today, speculative asset, into a store of value. And I think that it has to probably go through the institutions first before it hits mainstream. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, look, I totally agree. And I think evolution, you used exactly the right word. I wrote a letter about this a few quarters ago on kind of financial natural selection or the evolution of technology over revolutionary. I mean, there's nothing really revolutionary about the ideas of distributed ledger technology and triple entry accounting. There is some revolution in solving the double spend problem and getting a new technological application, a use case for DLT. But I do think that the evolution is more appropriate. And to your point, the big money is controlled by institutions, and the institutions have got to get comfortable with anything for it to become really part of the fabric of the investment landscape. I mean, go back 50, 60 years, most endowments, institutions, foundations, pensions were prohibited by charter in many cases from investing in stocks. I mean, think about that. They were mostly in fixed income securities, and then stocks were the new thing. They were the alternative investment. And then it was international stocks with Arisa back in the 70s. Oh my gosh, you're going to invest outside the borders of the United States. How risky. Not risky at all. But and then it was, you know, 20 plus years ago when I was back at Notre Dame, it was hedge funds and junk bonds. You know, first time we brought distressed securities to the board, they went, you can't invest in junk bonds. I'm like, wait a second. 55% of the fund is in equity, which is junior to even the worst debt. So think about it that way in terms of unsecured claims. And then when we tried hedge funds, like, oh no, you can't invest in hedge funds because that's where all the bad people are. Like, what are you talking about? They're like, well, they charge these high fees. Like, well, in what business do you know does the best person not charge the highest fee, right? Yeah. Doctor, lawyer, football coach, basketball player. That's the way the world works. So, and then it was private equity and venture capital and all these assets eventually become mainstream because, as you point out, the institutions finally become comfortable. And it's not until that time when the rest of the investment landscape, and particularly the firms, right? Here's the crazy thing. There are asset management firms. I was just having a conversation with my wife last night. She's got a little bit of capital. She's investing. And I was talking about, hey, maybe we should put some exposure to Bitcoin in there. Let's just buy GBTC because it's easy. Oh, yeah. You know, the brokerage firm that we work with for her account, they prohibit ownership of GBTC. Hmm. That's just silly. Yeah. And it goes further. There's one firm out there, I won't name names, but it's the biggest one, brokerage firm. Not only do they not let you own GBTC, they won't let a financial advisor take a new client if their wealth was created by crypto.
Wow.
That is absolutely insane on every level.
Wow. Yeah, that's insane. So you've seen this, I guess, you've seen this where you had to kind of go back to these funds or these endowments and tell them over and over, hey, you should look at this. Or so you kind of had this history of breaking new assets or riskier assets in. So I guess you've seen this play out before. And so today you're there kind of pitching these guys now saying, hey, this is the new thing that you need to consider.
Yeah, and look, as you said, I'm a big movie buff, seen this movie before. This is not the first time. It won't be the last time. Look, innovation is scary, you know, for the name of your pod, right? You know, market disruptors.
Right.
It's all about disruption and disruptive innovation. And every incumbent fears disruption, as they should. And, you know, the street sweepers passed out pamphlets saying that if you got in an automobile, you'd die. And, you know, the candle makers passed out stuff saying, you know, you'd go blind if you look at that, you know, glowing orb that Mr. Edison created.
Sure.
Or my grandfather-in-law's parents, you know, chastised him from leaving the safe job at the railroad to take the risky job at that American Airlines company.
Yeah.
And, you know, because people really believed that if you got in an airplane and you went faster than a certain miles per hour, that your body would cave in on itself. So there's all this fear, uncertainty, and doubt around disruption. And it occurs in every disruptive phase, whether it's technology, whether it's innovation, whether it's custom. I mean, think about Galileo, poor Galileo, right? It's like, you know, guys, my data says that the Earth actually revolves around the sun, not vice versa. And they label him a heretic and, you know, wanted to burn him at the stake. But it is dangerous to have a view different from the masses, but that's where all the great wealth is created. That's my pinned tweet on Twitter, right? Yep. Is great wealth is created by investing in something that you believe in before everyone else even understands.
Yep. So having seen this movie before, you have a perspective there, but you're also on the front lines talking to them about it. Where are we? I mean, I'm guessing over the last year, you've seen a lot of people starting to warm up to this idea. I mean, we've seen, you know, maybe the Yale Endowment Fund dip their toe in the water a little bit. Like, so where are we with that?
Yeah, look, I mean, Yale got a lot of press, but they barely dipped the tip of their toenail. I mean, the amount of assets they put in the fund relative to their total assets was teeny tiny. The guys who actually get credit is Harvard. Harvard put in some real money. They went big into the fund, about 10 times as much as Yale put in. And then they went into a direct deal. So that's pretty exciting. And Narv is a great CIO over there at Harvard. So If you think about what's going on, we're still in that, you know, early adopter phase. You know, we haven't even gotten into the early majority. And I'll say in the individual world, the retail world, we're probably in the early majority, but we're just at the very knee of the S curve. You know, we're probably going from like 8% to 11 or 12, 13% in terms of adoption. And we've got a long way to go before we've got full adoption. And there's the couple things at work here. One, there's the fear, right? You know, you got people of influence like Jamie Dimon or Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger, you know, calling it bad names, a fraud, or, yep. You know, Warren calls it rat poison. I always say, well, how do you know what rat poison tastes like? and then you got Charlie saying it's like trading, you know, harvested baby brains. I'm like, really? WTF, Charlie? Seriously?
Yeah.
Baby brains? So why do those guys want you to fear it? Well, 46% of Berkshire Hathaway is in financial services. Financial services are at risk of being disrupted by this new technology. And so they're going to say bad things about it. And one of the things that's important for institutions is to consider the source, right? Don't listen to people who are shilling projects that have no, you know, foundation or basis in the future. You know, you look at, I don't like the term, but you know, people call them shit coins, right? And they're not even coins, right? They're utility tokens. They're basically pre-seed and seed stage venture capital projects, which have a 95% loss ratio, which should not be surprising to anybody. Right. Most companies fail. And there's only about a dozen or so cryptocurrencies that actually should be called cryptocurrencies. Everything else should be called utility token and call it what it is,
right?
Pre-seed stage venture. So focusing on the differences and not conflating terms and getting information right is going to help. The second thing is don't listen to the FOMO either. You know, you got the people who are, oh, we're going to miss it. You got to get it. No, right? There's plenty of time to, you know, have a plan, find good people to work with, find a logical stepwise progression. You know, you don't have to just invest in cryptocurrency. You can invest in venture capital, in infrastructure, you can invest in lending, you can invest in certain forms of cryptocurrency or even derivatives related to cryptocurrency. There's lots of things that are evolving for institutions to look at. And the smart ones, and we've fortunately found a handful of the smart ones, are doing just that.
So you're talking about and not just buying coins, but buying in like infrastructure plays. So like, for example, Microsoft has been and probably will be a big beneficiary. You could look at like NVIDIA making video cards for mining. So stuff like that.
Yeah, look, there's all the way to that extreme that you're talking about, which are the existing companies that support the ongoing development. And, you know, the challenge is finding the right ones. It's like IBM. IBM, what they're doing in blockchain is really interesting, but it's such a tiny piece of their overall dying business that I probably wouldn't buy that stock. Right. Microsoft, a little bit different, a little bit better. Something like AMD or NVIDIA, you know, or AMD in particular, where you've got so much of the exposure of their business to this evolving technology, I like it a lot. Now, it's gone up a lot, and I think it's a little richly priced today. But that's just, you know, how you do it. You buy the dips and you hold for long periods of time on those companies that are helping to build out the infrastructure. But when I talk about infrastructure, I mean the private investments in the private businesses that truly are building out, you know, exchanges, software, tools, you know, education resources. You know, somebody's going to create the Bloomberg of crypto. We think we've invested in that firm. Digital asset data, but we'll see.
Yeah. Great. So we're in that evolution stage. It's happening. But it seems like there's stuff going on globally that's seeming like it wants to accelerate that, right? It's like almost like all these like global macro policies are like just wanting people to buy a Bitcoin or adopt an alternative system. And I know you've talked a lot about, you've tweeted a lot about like QE, zombie companies, negative interest rates. Right. And so these are all things that possibly could be these black swan events or really push this. Is that what you think?
Look, you know, absolutely. You know, the macro is lining up and has been lining up for a decade. Now, it's not a coincidence that Bitcoin in particular, as a use case for blockchain technology and specifically about monetization of value or money, or stores of value came about in 2009, right? That's not a surprise. At the trough of the global financial crisis, you know, the Genesis block refers to the Chancellor's second bailout of the banks. Yep. And everything that's gone on in the last decade, from central banks becoming very, very kind of omniscient, godlike people. You know, a friend of mine says it best, right? I remember a time when I didn't know the names of central bankers. I long for those days to return.
Right.
And, you know, they are the idea that if it was easy to create wealth by printing money, literally by pushing a button and printing money, literally physically printing press kind of physical notes and coins, or, you know, ones and zeros in a bank account. If it were that easy, then wouldn't everybody do it? Wouldn't every country just print as much currency as they possibly could?
Well, they all try, don't they?
And they do try, right? And we've seen the outcome, right? We've seen the hyperinflationary outcome in places like Zimbabwe or Venezuela. You know, a cup of coffee a year ago cost, you know, 9 cents. Today it costs, you know, what is it, $14,000 or something.
Right.
44,000% monthly inflation. So now that's the hyperinflation side. The thing that I'm more worried about is the deflationary side, which is you got bad demographics, right? You got too many old people, meaning 65 to 85, and 65 to 85 year old people don't spend as much as 45 to 65 year old people. They're not as productive. Then you got too much debt. You got all the developed world, Japan, US, Europe, you know, most of the developed world drowning in debt and overspending. You know, we're $1 trillion deficit in the United States because of the silly tax reform act that we passed a year and a half ago. And then on top of that, you got deflation. So deflation is essentially putting us in this place where we feel compelled as governments to print more currency and devalue our currency in a race to the bottom to try to inflate our way out of the debt, but it's not working. And so what the problem is that we have is you have this, like you said, the perfect storm for a fixed supply, hard currency or sound money like Bitcoin to come in and say, wait a second, if I want to opt out of the fiat currency system or the fiat fiasco, as I like to call it, if you want to opt out of that and have a little bit of chaos hedge or a little, you know, schmuck insurance, as somebody called it. I should give credit, but I can't remember who said it. But the schmuck insurance, you know, we got schmuck leaders all around the world doing stupid stuff, whether it's bad policies like trade wars, whether it's bad decisions like, you know, budget deficits, spending, whether it's bad things like QE, all of that is leading to this devaluation and this depreciation of the value of these assets. And look, if I were them and I were the dictator, I would do the same thing. Well, actually, I wouldn't because I have a conscience. But dictators go by the dictator playbook, right? They amass the assets, then they devalue the currency. That's the way it works. And that's exactly what's happening today. And the problem is the average person, right? Average person in America doesn't hold a stock. Right. 49% of people in this country have no stock. Not one. Not they don't have a 401k plan. They don't have a pension fund. They don't own stock directly. They are not benefiting by the increase of real assets, financial assets. They would benefit from holding a sound monetary aggregate like Bitcoin.
Yeah, and that's why we have this growing divide between the rich and the poor. The rich are inflating their assets. The poor don't have assets, and because their money is becoming less value, their wages have gone down. Their purchasing power has gone down at the same time. So it's like this growing gap.
Well, it's the worst since the 1930s. It's the worst income and wealth inequality in the history of the United States. We were doing better from kind of 1930 through the late 60s, and really since 1971, when we did, you know, the fiat fiasco, we went off the gold standard. And some would say, well, you know, all of this isn't working. You know, the QE is not working, the change of the gold standard. No, it's working exactly as they planned. If you actually stop for a second and say, wait, the haves like being the haves, and they would like to have a greater percentage of what they have, then it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And the have-nots don't seem to, what I don't understand is the have-nots seemingly vote for the policies that are making them less rich.
Well, it's not, we're in an election cycle, so it's not, I don't think it's hard to understand why. I mean, if you look at the debates that have been going on, someone's promising free education, someone's promising free reparations, someone's promising free $1,000 a month, someone's promising, I mean, and so QE pays for that, right? Like that pays for that. So it's not a big stretch to see how that gets in, but we don't want to jump into politics because we could go crazy there. But we do have these narratives in Bitcoin, right? And so we're always talking about, it seems like it drives this. And so one narrative I see is like, and people have latched onto this, is we talk about the economy's good, the economy's good, the economy's good, because the stock market is high.
Yeah.
But the stock market being high doesn't mean the economy's good, especially for the little guy, right? That's what you're saying.
Not at all. No, in fact, you bring up one of the most important points, is the economy is not the stock market, and the stock market is not the economy. And there are lots of examples, right? The fastest growing economies in the world over the last two decades have not had the best performing stock markets, right? The best performing stock market in the world the last 2 years is Venezuela. Their economy is in the shitter. I mean, I hate to use that word, but that's where it is. But it's the best performing stock market because on a nominal value, the price of things goes up and the dictators takes all the assets because they own all the assets. So to your point, everyone points to, oh, the economy is great. Well, the economy is actually not good. The economy is good on some measures. You can say, well, a lot of people are working. Well, how are they working?
Right.
Are they underemployed? Are they fully employed? You know, if you lose your job as a manager at AT&T and you take a job as a barista, you still show up as employed. Right. Now, I would argue your life is less good, unless maybe you want more free time. But then the other problem you have is every day someone turns 65, they get taken out of the workforce, or workforce participation rate drops. Then you got this other crazy thing called the birth-death ratio that occurs when the BLS, the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, makes up data based on where we are in the length of the economic cycle. They say, well, this many companies should be born, this many should die, so we have this many new jobs. Well, did you actually count the jobs? Oh, well, no. Well, you do realize that this recovery is half as strong as previous recovery. Sure, you're adjusting for that, right? Well, no.
Yeah.
Okay, so all of that, you know, indications of, oh, people point to, consumer confidence. Well, of course people have consumer confidence because they read the headlines every day. The stock market's great. Wow, right. Our president tweets about it, the tweeter in chief, every day. Well, except when the market goes down like today. He won't be tweeting today about the market.
But 50%, like you said, 50% of the people own no stock. So what do they even care?
Exactly.
But it makes them feel good.
The economy, we just had the worst 10 years of economic growth in the United States in history. Now, part of that is figures lie and liars figure, in the sense that it is the law of large numbers, and it is harder to grow a very large economy at a high rate, although China's doing a pretty good job of doing that. Everyone says, oh, it's made up. Well, what I love about that is people say, well, the Chinese data is made up. You mean more made up than our data? It's actually the same amount of made up. And in fact, Bloomberg tried to show how much the data was made up in China. So they created this thing called the Li Kuai Kong Index, which is, you know, using electricity and employment and money flows. And they calculated what they thought the GDP growth was. And it turned out that number was actually saying that China was understating their growth because they don't want to freak people out. So it is possible to grow quickly. You have to have a different type of command economy as opposed to a pure democracy. And some people would argue against that. But the bottom line is, you know, our growth in the United States is not high. Growth in Europe is not high. Growth in Japan is not high. It's a demographic problem. It's a debt problem. And all that comes together, back to your original point, it creates this perfect storm where the macro suddenly has, there's a role as a macro hedge or a safe haven. And I've gotten some great debate. It can't be a safe haven. It's too volatile. Well, if you define safe haven simply as volatility of an asset, you're missing the point. The point of a safe haven is, what do I feel comfortable and secure in holding a portion of my assets if there's chaos someplace else? And one of the best things about cryptocurrency, and Bitcoin in particular, it's not seizable, right? In some ways, it can actually be not recordable, meaning people don't know where you have it or where you're storing it. It can be moved globally, instantaneously. You know, all the things that we think about as safe haven, like gold, is really hard to to move around. It's heavy, you know, it's hard to divide. You got to pay someone to insure it or store it. You know, crypto has some huge advantages, and that's why I think Bitcoin as digital gold as its first use case is really quite interesting.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a minute. So, you know, we have this perfect storm. You kind of framed that up for us really, really well. Demographics and, you know, inflation, deflation, these things, and we have this chaos edge. So traditionally, gold has been that. When currencies inflate, people can go to gold because it's non-inflatable, can't be inflated. Potentially, right? Gold is called digital gold, or I'm sorry, Bitcoin is being called digital gold. But in an inflationary environment, gold should work really well. But we saw in 2008 that gold actually got hammered at the same time as the financial crash. However, it did bounce back right away. So it almost seems that you have this deflationary move that happens first, right? This debt deleveraging, which pushes gold down. But then all of a sudden, they're going to start printing to try to reinflate it, which then pushes it back up. So is that kind of what you see?
Absolutely. Well, the thing about gold, it's the only asset in the world until Bitcoin was created that acts both as a currency and a commodity. And so you think about it, there are lots of commodities, and commodities can do, you know, very poorly in an economic downturn. A global financial crisis was certainly an economic downturn, and a lot of people thought of gold in its commodity form first, and they sold. Then it turns to currency or store of value, and then people are, oh, geez, you know, there's going to be this Fed reaction or this central bank reaction, and I'm going to need an inflation hedge. The problem is we haven't had any inflation. We've had deflation. And so gold does have this really interesting history. And, you know, people say, well, it has people have faith in it. Well, no, what they have is it's custom, right? It's been a custom for 5,000 years. It's a long time. That 1 ounce of gold has bought a fine man's suit. And so despite all the ups and downs of currency, you know, there have been 775 paper currencies in the history of the world, 3/4 of them no longer exist. And the rest of them will go away over time too, because paper currency will always go away because it's not backed by anything. It's fiat. And so ultimately gold does act as that store, but the reason that it has is custom. Now, what's interesting is in the last 10 years, there's been this new customary asset, Bitcoin, where people, particularly young people, say, it's more portable. It's more easily stored. It's more easily divided. It may actually have another use case as a method of payment at some point, although it's pretty slow to do that. It'll probably be a second layer like Lightning. But the bottom line is, if you ask the average 35-year-old or younger, how much gold do you own? Well, none. Why would I ever own gold? Right. If you ask them how much Bitcoin they have, the answers might surprise you. Some at 30, 40, 50, 60%. And that is a difference in other assets. And one of the things I really, really love about Bitcoin, and one of the things that reasons I think institutions will adopt it sooner rather than later, is, look, I've been doing this a long time. I got white hair to prove it. Although my son said, you know, this weekend, Dad, your hair's still black in the back. I'm like, well, yeah, okay. But I've been around long enough to see all of these promises of alternative investments that are going to give you a better return or lower correlation or a diversification benefit. And, you know, international stocks, 70% correlated, hedge funds, 40, 50% correlated, even bonds, 30% correlated. So they don't give you this perfect correlation hedge. Bitcoin, interestingly, through the ups, through the downs, good, bad, is only 15.15 correlated. And in some cases, like May and today, it actually has negative correlation. So I'm not saying it's going to be negatively correlated all the time. It's not going to be a perfect hedge. But that 0.15 correlation is really important. And where does it come from? It comes from the fact that stocks, bonds, commodities, traditional assets all derive their value from the same thing: economic growth, interest rates, and central bank policies. Bitcoin derives its value from very different things: technology, regulatory changes, millennial usage, and this need for an alternative store of value. So it moves differently and independently, which is a huge advantage when you build it into a portfolio.
So when you're building that into a portfolio, you want to take into consideration the volatility that it has, which is kind of the risk that it has. So with Bitcoin, we have this huge asymmetric upside, with, you know, a smaller downside, but it's also way more volatile, which, you know, has a risk adjusted basis. So then when you're putting it into whatever portfolio, whether that be an institutional portfolio or a retail portfolio, you should try to consider that. And how does someone look at that?
Well, you definitely have to consider, but here's the problem with volatility. Volatility is not risk, right? Risk is risk of absolute loss or permanent impairment of capital. The interesting thing is Harry Markowitz. I'm a big Harry Markowitz fan. In fact, I got to have dinner with him once, and you know, I got to ask him this question. And I had heard that he said once that he wouldn't have used volatility for the capital asset pricing model. He would have used semi-variance because you should only penalize an asset for downside volatility. We all want upside volatility. That's what we crave.
Right.
In fact, we should want as much upside volatility as we can possibly get.
Of course.
And I said, would you... Is it true that you said I would have used semivariance, but the math was too hard? And he said, well, of course. And I wouldn't have won the Nobel Prize. I really wanted to win the Nobel Prize. So when you penalize an asset for upside volatility, that's a perversion of the whole idea of assets. What we want are assets that have asymmetric upside, and we're willing to accept some downside risk, but we can hedge most of that downside risk away with other assets or with position sizing. You know, I use this example over the last 5 years. So 5 years is a reasonable time because at that point you could have put 1% of endowment assets into Bitcoin. So over the last 5 years, if you had taken 1% and put it in Bitcoin, 0.5% from stocks, 0.5% from bonds, and endowments over the last 5 years made 7.2%. That 1% allocation of Bitcoin would have taken it to 9.2. Had that 1% gone to zero, you would have only gone to 7%. So 0.2% downside, 200 basis points of upside. That's a 10-to-1 asymmetry. So we should embrace that upside volatility and be mindful of downside volatility and risk. But the interesting thing about it is the risk of total loss is very low at this point because of lots of things related to Metcalfe's law and the Lindy effect. The longer something survives, the longer it's likely to survive. And the way Satoshi-san, whoever Satoshi-san is, or the people, or they, or them, or whatever, whoever designed it was genius in the sense that there are these embedded advantages for its longevity, right? Because as the price declines, more people are going to want to own it. As the price declines, the difficulty adjusts in the mining algorithms, and so more people are incented to mine. And so there's this beautiful yin and yang about the asset. And I would say the miracle was it went from $0 to $10.
Right.
10 right. to 100, 100 to 1,000, 1,000 to 10,000, 10,000 to a million. That's not a miracle. That's just increased usage and increased adoption. The miracle was that it survived getting usage at all and became a custom where we could exchange it for value.
And it survived that first really bad bear, yeah. That bear crash, that bear market. So when it survived that one, it was like, wow, this thing's resilient. Now it's survived a couple of them, yes. Which makes it even more resilient. So investors should look at it as a total loss and not just the downside or the temporary downside, I guess, if you're looking out over a long enough time frame as well, right?
Well, so, look at it. What is it? 97 or 98% of all days that it's been in existence, you've made money. So if you bought it, other than like 1 or 2% of days, you've made money. So yeah, if you chased it on December 18th, 2017, you paid $20,000, you're down. But other than a handful of days, it's been a positive asset. And the thing that people focus on that I think is improper is they focus on the peak price. Price is a liar, right? The value of any asset is the value. The price is just what two people decide to exchange some unit in the current period.
Right.
And so when assets get above their fair value, they tend to fall back to fair value. When they get below fair value, they tend to go back up to fair value. And so when we look at it, we look and say, meaning attractive or unattractive, but what we should really look at as a diversifying asset is each year over the 10 years, the low has been higher. That's incredible. That means fundamentally more people are using it, more people are holding it, more people are looking for additional use cases. And if that trend continues and every year we get higher lows, that's very positive for the future.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, like you said, the price is a liar. Really, we have valuations, which is difficult to price because we don't really know exactly what it is. I've been having fun watching these macro guys like Raul Paul and Dan Tapiero starting to talk about this. And they have this different perspective that makes it seem so much bigger than it is. And there was another article that I saw you talk about that was like something about it was talking about the volatility, something and then nothing at all or whatever. And he just said, hey, we have this global transfer system of transferring value peer to peer. Like, what's that worth? Is that worth $200 billion? I guess it's worth a lot more than $200 billion.
It's worth a lot more than $200 billion. And look, what people aren't capable of understanding yet, and it's not a criticism of anybody. It's just, this is how big technological evolutions happen, right? When the internet was founded, there were very, very few people, right? Myself included, who saw the incredible upside potential. Now, we made some good investments. You know, we invested in Google and we made, you know, 200 times our money, and we invested in Sycamore and Sienna and a whole bunch of other things. We made a bunch of money, but I didn't buy, you know, Amazon on the IPO and hold it to today, and, you know, I wouldn't even have to work.
Yeah.
So, because it was hard to see the upside potential, because when Netflix came out, it was a crappy little company. Those discs got broken, they got lost, they were hard, and then it was going to be video on demand. Well, you couldn't do video on demand with 2,400 baud modems. And so that business was going to die. And then Blockbuster was going to put them out of business. And then suddenly, what happened? Well, South Korea gave us broadband. Now, when broadband came, we're like, whoa. Now we can do streaming. We don't call it video on demand anymore. We call it streaming. And what people weren't capable of understanding is just how many people would cut the cord and transfer to streaming instead of cable. And the same thing's true with the mobile net, right? When I remember 2010 being in Craig McCaw's house up in Seattle for a party, and, you know, talking to the head of his family office. You know, Craig was the original investors in mobile telephony. And I asked this guy, I said, what, you know, do you think the mobile net will be as big as the internet? He's like, Mark, are you kidding me? You ask people 15 years ago if they want a computer, like, what do I want a computer in my house for? You ask people today if they want a cell phone, like, well, I already got two. Probably don't need another one. But yeah, if it could be faster and do more, it'd be awesome. And then 10 years ago, the iPhone, or 11 years ago, the iPhone comes out, and suddenly our world has changed. And now we all got sore thumbs and crooked neck and these bolts on the back of our head from leaning over too much. But, you know, we can't comprehend the change that's going to occur. And when you take money and value and all the assets in the world, and you think about what will be done to them, the same thing that the internet did to, or what email did to information, or what the internet did to commerce, it's really incomprehensible. And I think that's why people struggle with getting exposure and making an investment, because they can't see the future, because the future's happened tomorrow. It's going to happen over a decade or 15 or 20 years. But think about this. Forget digital gold, right? That's a $7.5 trillion market. What about money market accounts? What about just, instead of having a bank money where the bank could take assets like they did in Cyprus, what if I had an unseizable asset like Bitcoin and I could have that be my money market? Oh, that's pretty interesting. That's why the government, and Libra is not even a cryptocurrency, right? It's a centralized corporate digital asset, but it still could be the largest money market in the world by a factor of 10. If they instantly distributed it to all their clients. So yeah, governments don't like that. It drains assets from the banking system. Think about this. Alibaba created a money market account back 5 years ago, maybe 7 years ago. And in 9 months, they're $80 billion. It became the third largest money market in the world in 9 months. It took 40 years for Vanguard and Fidelity to get up to $100 billion. And the PBOC said, whoa, time out. We're changing the banking laws. You can't do this because you're siphoning assets out of our banking system. Today, that account, without any new assets, for $200 billion, by far the largest money market in the world. And that's what can happen with new technology. And so then we go from there to, well, what about currencies? Do we really need all the different currencies around the world? What about a borderless currency? It's possible. That's $86 trillion market. Well, what about real estate? That's three times as big. How about that? $220 billion. I'm sorry, $220 trillion. So $6 trillion, not billion. So then you go to total private businesses and total assets. We're talking $700 trillion of assets that will be digitized, that will be traded freely 24/7. They'll be owned in a fractional basis. I mean, the future is so big. It's almost too big to comprehend. And that's why people just don't do anything.
Yeah, boy, it is too big to comprehend. The big risk that we have, though, is, as you said, these disruptive technologies, companies don't like that. Blockbuster obviously didn't like getting taken out by Netflix. But now we have sovereigns. Now we have governments. So the PBOC says, hey, no, Alibaba, you can't do that. So now we don't really have this free market anymore. Now all of a sudden we have like governments that maybe will shut it down. So I think that adds an element of risk in addition to just like new technology risk. I mean, we have government regulation risk now.
It's a really, really important point. And that's not new in the sense that, you know, the government tried to regulate the internet and, you know, they tried to regulate cell phones and, you know, look, we got all of these things occur when interested parties feel their dominance slipping, right? Financial service institutions don't like the idea that you and I can exchange value today directly, and we don't need a bank. You don't need a bank account. I don't need an account. I can transfer value to you instantaneously. And let's do that across borders. Well, that's the problem is today, Western Union charges 12%. If I want to send money to my mother-in-law in Brazil, I don't have a mother-in-law in Brazil, but if I did, and I want to send her money, it cost me 12%. But my mother-in-law is in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It doesn't cost money to send money there. But the key is that if I have money across borders, you know, the Rothschilds like the fact that their two banks get paid, and they don't want that to go away. So over time, disruptive innovation is going to dominate, and there's no putting the genie back in the bottle here. We're going to see increased usage. We're going to see different use cases. We're going to see government pushback. We're going to see regulatory. But the key is, in a borderless world, in a decentralized world, or decentraland, which is one of the terms I like, in decentraland, if the U.S. makes it really hard to open businesses around this new technology, what will happen? They'll open up in Russia. They'll open up in China. They'll open up in Argentina. They'll open up in the Bahamas or Cayman. And that will happen. The question is going to happen. And then, well, can people then make it criminal to own the asset? People forget it was against the law to own gold from 1933 to 1973. Literally against the law in the United States to own gold. Plenty of people own gold. So it's got to be enforced. It's got to be monitored. So all these things become tougher in a decentralized world where, you know, you literally can store your Bitcoin in your head, right? You don't have to have it on your computer, you don't have it on your phone. You can have your seed phrase in your head and just be happy. Now, will they start interrogating you? Absolutely. But people will figure out a way around that. I heard one guy say, well, I just wipe my computer before I go through. Yeah, but now blank computer, you're more suspect than the guy who has, you know, a Coinbase account on his computer. So we'll all figure it out.
Yeah. All right. Well, such good information there. I really appreciate you taking the time. We'll go ahead and try and wrap this up. I'm just curious, now that we've talked about this global stage that's setting up to create this perfect storm to push this, lots of risk in the world where, you know, all these accounts are overvalued and potentially, you know, markets could come crashing down at any point. But at the same time, we have this new asset class. How do people look at this? I mean, where are the safe places for people to go? Buy Bitcoin and buy gold? Keep cash?
Okay. I love it. It's the ultimate softball question for my favorite hashtag, which is hashtag get off zero. 10 years from now, we're going to look back and it will be fiduciarily irresponsible for anyone, individual, institution, or investor to have zero exposure to crypto assets, and particularly Bitcoin. It'll be irresponsible. And why is that? It's because when you look around the world, as you just summarized perfectly, just about every asset class is in a bubble. Real estate's in a bubble. Stocks are in a bubble. Government bonds are in the greatest bubble in the history of bubbles. I mean, the fact that the Greek 10-year trades below treasuries, absolute insanity. The fact that Italian interest rates are single digits, insanity. So when the buyer of last resort is a government entity that can print money at a whim to buy assets and they don't have economic reasons to own, yeah, we get bubbles. And it is irresponsible to own debt of corporations that are wildly overlevered. It's irresponsible to own equity of companies like Tesla, where they don't have enough money to pay back their debt holders, let alone the equity holders. So I think what's going to happen over time is people are going to wake up. They're going to say, oh, there are these diversifying assets, and they're going to start with 1%, then 2, then 5, then 8, then 10, then 15, then 20. And the younger you are, the more you should have, because you've got this wonderful thing like a pseudo fixed income instrument, which is your future earnings potential. Right? A young person should have zero bonds, none, right? Their bond is their future earnings from jobs they're going to have over the years. And so you should have as much private investments, take advantage of the illiquidity premium. You should have as much diversifying assets or asymmetric assets like Bitcoin in your portfolio when you're young, because you've got more time to make up for your mistakes. And so, you know, Michael Steinhardt had a great line. He said, make all your mistakes when you're young. Okay. And that's how we should think about investing, is we should be pushing. And so I went on vacation last week, and I posted a picture on Twitter of me water skiing, and someone said, falls, ? And I said, if you're not falling, you're not skiing. So if you're not falling down occasionally, if you're not having a loss occasionally, if you're not having a setback occasionally investing, then you're not investing. You're not taking enough risk. And one of the things is people don't like to be wrong. So they don't put their opinion out there. They don't put positions on where they could be wrong or lose money. Well, the whole purpose of this business is sometimes being wrong, because you're only going to be right mathematically about half the time. And it's not whether you're right or wrong. It's how much money you make when you're right and how much money you lose when you're wrong. And Soros says it best. I'm only rich because I admit my mistakes faster than other people.
Yep.
And I cut my losses. And so good investors, great investors are wrong way more than bad investors, because bad investors are paralyzed by fear of being wrong. And so they sit in cash or bonds and don't do anything. And great investors make investments, take views, make, you know, wild assertions like I do all the time, saying, hey, I actually think there's going to be a value here. I think this asset's going to take off. You say, well, what if you're wrong? I'm wrong all the time. So I make a mistake, I change it, fix it, go on to the next idea. So the key to all of this is adopt a portion of your assets in these diversifying assets, particularly crypto assets, reduce your exposure to the overvalued assets around the world, and prepare for an environment at which stuff's going to go on sale. So there's a reason the very best investors in the world today have the highest cash positions they've ever had. Like one of my mentors, Julian Robertson, guy is always invested. He's basically fully in cash. He's got a lot of longs, a lot of shorts, but net, he's basically neutral, because he knows that assets are overvalued. He's short the overvalued assets. He's long the few things that he thinks are undervalued, and he's waiting with a lot of cash to buy the assets when they get cheap.
Just timing it is the problem, right? Japan's kept it going for 20, 30 years. How long can this game go on, right?
Absolutely. And look, the markets can behave irrationally longer than the rational investor can remain solvent. Only though, that only applies if you lever. If you don't lever up, cash is like Valium. It keeps you calm and it lets you wait out. But if you put a lot of leverage on your assets, yeah, you're going to get stopped out at precisely the wrong time. Leverage can never make a bad investment good, but it can make a good investment bad.
Yeah.
And so today, you want to have maximum flexibility. You want to have a focus on constantly rebalancing. And yeah, could this game go on longer than I think it can? Of course. Will central banks do everything they can to keep it going? Of course. Will the elites do everything they can, including passing stupid laws? Of course. But at the end, I believe gravity rules, right? Newton was right. And assets return to their fair value and even go below. And if you wait long enough, you get to buy them at with a margin of safety, which is the key to life.
Yeah. Awesome. Such good stuff. you're definitely a wealth of knowledge. And I appreciate you sharing that with me and the audience.
Great conversation.
So anybody listening should definitely be following you on Twitter because you put out a lot of good information, a lot of retweets. I don't know how you get any work done.
My wife asked me the same thing. She thinks I'm a Twitteraholic, but look, Twitter is awesome because one, it's an engaged community and I've made some incredible relationships around the world, been introduced to some really cool opportunities. The second thing I love is I get instant feedback. Right. And when I put out an idea and everybody hates on it, I'm like, ooh, that's a pretty good idea. Or if I put out an idea and everybody loves it, I'm like, ooh, maybe that's already in the price.
Right.
So great instant feedback. But the thing I really like about it is it's a way to build and grow a community of like-minded people in different areas, whether it be crypto or finance or China. So we didn't even get to talk about China. Maybe we'll do that next time. But there's so much going on in the world today. And one thing I really like about Twitter is it's instantaneous. I don't have to wait for a producer to review a journalist's article, and 8 hours later I get, you know, somebody's view of what happened. I can watch a Periscope live of people standing in the polling place in Argentina and get a sense that Macri's going to win and good things are going to happen. So very cool stuff.
Is there anywhere else that anyone should follow you? Do you write like blogs or do you have anything else or just follow you on Twitter?
Our website is morgancreekcap.com. And we've got a lot of quarterly letters that I've written over the years, a number of them on Bitcoin and crypto of the last couple of years, kind of on the origins. And then we've also got a YouTube channel called Around the World with Yusko. And I've got a lot of presentations, about 45 minutes each with audio that we do on a monthly basis. We post those and I've got a number on crypto and China and energy and stocks and you name a topic, it's out there.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to share the information with you. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
Hey, if you like this episode of the Market Disruptors podcast, please help us take this to the top of the podcast charts. Just please do me a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. Taking 15 seconds to just leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us reach more people and disrupt more markets. I really appreciate you listening, and I'll see you next time on the Market Disruptors podcast.